Remember when education was about the fundamental skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic, and about reading great literature and studying history to give our kids a model for what it is to be a good person? Memoria Press's Classical Christian Curriculum offers that very model for your homeschool. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR20. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
You've got casinos operating at 50% capacity with hundreds of thousands of people going through them, and you've got these churches limited to 50 people. I think the proof is in the pudding.
Divorce is really just the kickoff of a lifetime of transition, loss, and instability for kids. And if you're a child of divorce, you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Those who view science and faith as enemies understand neither.
Muhammad, he wants you to believe him on force. For Jesus, he does things to make you want to believe him.
Parents trying to attend a virtual conference with a toddler in the living room. Love issues, etc.
Where it might be to create this Islamic world.
I think we thought it was safely discredited. Maybe it's still festered in elite university classrooms or think tanks, or maybe even among the graduate students at various elite universities in academic areas. But socialism hasn't remained isolated to those little enclaves that will always have its fans. It's taken to the streets. It's now being elected to high office in the United States. How did socialism become popular yet again? And what is its allure, especially with young people? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live this Monday afternoon, August the 3rd. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk about the allure of socialism. Ian Murray will join us. He's author of the new book, The Socialist Temptation. Then we'll spend some time with Pastor Sean Denzer, director of worship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, talking about Lutheran worship myths. You can join us with questions or comments. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-MY-IE. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet at issuesetc, or the Issues Etc. listener comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about the allure of socialism, Ian Murray. He's director of the Center for Economic Freedom at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., and author of the new book, The Socialist Temptation. Ian, welcome.
It's a delight to be with you today.
There are a lot of misconceptions about socialism. What are some of them?
Well, I think one of the biggest misconceptions is that socialism is just an economic philosophy, and that it's all about the economic arrangement of society. One of the reasons why I think we've seen socialism resurge is because it actually does a very good job of speaking to some fundamental American values. One of those fundamental American values is equality. Socialism pitches much of its appeal in the language of equality. But it also tries to appeal to the fundamental American value of freedom. Workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains, is one of the most famous lines of socialism. It's all about, they've managed to pitch socialist ideas as being conducive to the value of freedom, and also to that really fundamental American value of community. There's a line of argument that it's only with the policies of socialism that we can reestablish the community that so many of us feel that America has lost.
So what is socialism in a nutshell?
Well, that's a very good question, because these days, socialism, if you talk to socialists, they do not say that they want to institute the communist society that Karl Marx talked about in the Communist Manifesto. They'd much rather have us be something like Scandinavia, like Sweden, which they point to as a great model. But when you look at Sweden and you look at the policies that Sweden has in place, you'll find that they're actually a much more free market, much more capitalist even, society than the policies that socialists would like to put in place, like the Green New Deal, and a lot of policies that are all aimed at redistributing wealth and bringing corporate America under control and policing what you can and can't say. And that's a very different thing to what's actually happening in Sweden. So one of the things that we need to do is to ask socialists to really explain what they mean, because when you look at the list of policies that they have, that's at odds with their public statements.
Many in my generation, having witnessed the end of the Cold War and the fall of the Berlin Wall, assumed that socialism had been entirely discredited. Were we wrong?
Well, this is actually an identifiable cycle which happens time and time again. When socialism is set up, when a socialist state is created, there is a great cry that goes out saying, yes, at last, here it is, the utopia, the new dawn. This is the international brotherhood of man, finally made flesh, and this is a real socialist state. Then after a few years, the wheels start to come up, thanks to the contradictions of socialism that I talk about in Socialist Temptation, at which point they start saying, oh no, this can't be the fault of socialism, it's the fault of saboteurs and wreckers and foreign agents and possibly the CIA. And in fact, that's where we are with Venezuela at the moment. Most socialists are saying that Venezuela's economic collapse is not due to its socialist policies, but due to outside interference from economic sanctions and from the CIA. And then finally, when everything has gone to heck in a handbasket and the economy is totally destroyed and perhaps, unfortunately, many, many, many thousands are dead, that's when they turn around and say, no, that wasn't real socialism. What we are going to do with next time is actually do real socialism. So ignore the failures of the past. And I think that's where we are at the moment, that unfortunately far too many people have listened to this argument and believe that what happened in the past was not real socialism, and that what has been promised will be, when you get down to it, it's still the same old solutions that led to that disaster.
Is the history of socialism, that cycle that you just described that has been witnessed again and again, is it being taught in schools and universities?
Unfortunately, no. It is in economics class, in most universities' economics classes. Unfortunately, when you look at the syllabuses of history classes and so on, they're not teaching it that way. Actually, my friend Phil Magnus, who's an economic historian, has done, and I talk about this in The Socialist Temptation, has researched what texts are being prescribed to young people at university these days. And he finds that the number one text that's being prescribed is Plato's Republic, which I think we can accept is an important part of history. But the number two text that is being prescribed is the Communist Manifesto. And moreover, this isn't being assigned in economics class, it's being assigned in history class, but it's also being assigned in English class and any of the classes that have the word studies after them. It's being assigned in anthropology, it's being assigned in sociology, it's being assigned uncritically. And then the disasters of socialism are not really being discussed.
So, in essence, socialism, or at least the socialist propaganda, is going unchecked, at least to that degree.
Yes, indeed. As I say, economics classes tend to actually counteract that to some degree, but not many people take economics classes, and that is a unfortunate reality. If we are seeing socialism basically forced down the throats of our young people, I'm afraid it should come as no surprise that they are vomiting back up socialist policies when they think about politics.
So is it that they are attracted, these young people, that they're attracted to socialism, or that they simply don't know anything else?
I think one of the issues is that socialism provides easy and intuitive answers to the problems that we see in America today. And this is why, as I mentioned earlier, the socialists are able to talk the language of American values so easily, because they have what seem to be intuitive answers to America's problems. It's only when you actually get down to the economics and how people actually behave under socialism that's when you learn that these easy answers are actually false answers. And we need to do a better job of explaining why those easy answers need to be rejected.
So you spoke a moment ago about the internal contradictions of socialism that eventually destroy any socialist enterprise. Let's talk about the false promises of socialism. What are they specifically?
Well, the first is that you can rob Peter to pay Paul. The idea that you can have a form of redistributive justice, that economic justice, that allows everyone to live an equitable life at the expense of those people who have unfairly benefited from the previous economic system. That's the idea, that, you know, if we take the money from the rich who don't deserve it and give it to the people who do deserve it, then all will be well. Unfortunately, every time that's been tried, it has proved to be disastrous. There aren't enough rich people to provide for the promises that are made for redistribution. And then there's a question of how this is all done. Can we have an equitable society, a fair society where everyone is equal, when there are people who are overseeing this new society and trying to make sure that everything is equal? Those people, in the end, turn into a new class, a new ruling class of apparatchiks and bureaucrats who just replace the old ruling class, except the old ruling class may have been, to a greater or lesser extent, productive. The new bureaucratic class is not productive at all. It turns into a drain on society. They engage in something which the great economist Friedrich Hayek called the fatal conceit, which is the belief that they are clever enough and knowledgeable enough that they can plan the society, and it turns out that nobody can be knowledgeable or enough to plan the society, and so their plans always fail. And as a result, you have a new society ruled, which is horribly unfair, ruled by people who literally don't know what they're doing. Inevitable result of that is economic collapse.
So what would socialism, if attempted, do to the American economy? How would it look?
Well, if you listen to the socialists and give them their due, they will say that it will be a fairer economy, which is better for those people who have been oppressed, better for the environment, and better for just America as a whole. What instead it will look like is what I just suggested, which is an America ruled by a new class of bureaucrats and apparatchiks. Now, the socialists say that they do not want to do something which was very common in Europe in the wave of socialism in the 1930s and 40s, which is nationalize all industries so that they are under direct political control. They say they don't want to do that. They say that that was a mistake. But instead, what they want to do is micromanage it through regulation. So instead of having officials appointed to run the industries, the industries would theoretically be run by the private sector, but they would be very heavily overseen by the regulators. Now, what we know from the history of regulation is that the more powerful the regulators, the less innovative the industry, the less wealth is able to be created by the industry. So essentially, you will have functionally the same thing as a nationalized industry. It's just that when things go wrong, they'll be able to blame the managers of the industry rather than the bureaucrats taking the blame, despite the fact that inevitably it will be the bureaucrats who have caused the trouble.
What would socialism do to the Bill of Rights?
This is a very interesting question. I'm very glad you asked it. As I mentioned in The Socialist Temptation, socialists have a very different view of rights from the rest of us. The American conception of right is what we call a negative right, which is that you have the right for government not to do something to you. And apart from that, everything's fine. So the right to free speech, for instance, is a negative right, that government cannot come in and say, no, you can't say that. The right to freedom of worship is similarly a negative right. Government can't come in and tell people how to worship. for a socialist, what makes a right is not this negative conception of right, but a positive conception which says that a right is a right only if it redresses a current power imbalance. So you have a right to free speech if you are pointing out that the current establishment is oppressing a particular race or class or gender or whatever. If you stand up and say, no, no, that isn't the case, I'm exercising my free speech to defend this establishment, then you, under the socialist conception, you do not have that right. You can only exercise a right insofar as it redresses a power imbalance. And so you see that the growth of what we're seeing today with cancel culture and all the rest is actually an expression of what rights would be like under the socialist a socialist state in America. They may retain the Bill of Rights, but they would reinterpret what the rights actually mean so as to reinforce their cancel culture, as opposed to saying that freedom of speech means that we should get rid of such culture.
We're talking with Ian Murray about the allure of socialism. He's author of the new book, The Socialist Temptation. When we come back, what would socialism do to our public institutions? Stay tuned.
Looking for a foreign language program that will revolutionize your students' vocabulary knowledge and their understanding of grammar? How about a program that teaches critical thinking skills, too? Look no further than Memoria Press's Latin curriculum. Students of all ages can use these Latin study programs. Give your students the gift of Latin today. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR20. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
Smartest listeners in radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. The 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the allure of socialism. Ian Murray is our guest director of the Center for Economic Freedom at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C., author of the new book, The Socialist Temptation. So, Ian, what would socialism do to our public institutions?
I think the unfortunate answer to that is it would either abolish them or, perhaps even worse, subvert and undermine them. What you see when socialism takes over an institution is that it perverts its established reason for being in order to support the socialist interpretation of that reason, and then sets that in stone and polices it rigidly. So you see, a great example comes from my own home country of Great Britain. In the 1940s, they decided to set up socialized medicine, what is called the National Health Service. Socialized medicine over there is a single-payer system. So although your family doctor would still has what is technically a private practice, for the most part, they are being paid for the medical services they provide to you, not by you, but by the government. So very soon, what happened was that medical provision started being bureaucratized to the state where the actual results of the healthcare became some of the worst in the developed world. But at the same time, the public authorities told the British people that they were getting the best healthcare in the world. They were getting something that one of the expressions you hear from Britons about the National Health Service is that National Health Service is the envy of the world. So there is this socialism helping to enforce a sort of public dissonance about the health service. Everybody knows that there's something wrong with the health service, but they can't say it in public because it is the envy of the world. It's the best system out there. And in fact, it's now got to the stage where you might even say that National Health Service has supplanted the Church of England as the national faith of Great Britain. In order to keep it going, in order to keep this socialist system going, they have to maintain this image of the National Health Service as this perfect institution. And in the end, that delivers terrible healthcare results to the British people and subverts the truth.
In what ways has socialism already made inroads into our political thought and our institutions here in the U.S.?
Well, one of the things that I say in The Socialist Temptation is that America has already been through two waves of what I term socialism light. The progressive era in the time before the First World War, and then the New Deal. And what those did was that they helped set up a sort of constitutional apparatus which can enable socialism to be delivered quickly, nowhere more than in the apparatus of the administrative state, the bureaucratic state, the regulators, all those agencies, that alphabet soup of agencies that is out there. They are all potential vehicles for socialism, and in some cases, they do actually already provide some socialist thought for how America is run. It's important for us to remember that the National Recovery Administration was set up during the New Deal to micromanage the recovery of America from the Great Depression. Although that was found unconstitutional and abolished, essentially after FDR packed his court, much of what the National Recovery Administration had been came back again. And so we already have this apparatus of the socialist light apparatus, which is there ready to be unleashed on the American people. And what I think is the most insidious part of this is that as part of that, we have allowed a sort of second constitution to grow up. There are statutes and laws and conventions that are related to the Progressive Era and the New Deal, which successive courts, even the Supreme Court, have essentially given constitutional weight to, such that the National Labor Relations Act, for instance, will never be found unconstitutional. It's essentially a part of our Constitution now, despite not being written into the Constitution. And so you have this second Constitution that's grown up that will be a great enabler for socialism, so should we ever elect a socialist majority.
Why do environmentalism and socialism seem to have such an affinity for one another?
Yes, this is a very important point. I talk about it in The Socialist Temptation quite a bit. The belief is that the environment has suffered because of capitalism, and that therefore, if we are to restore the environment, we have to get rid of capitalism, and socialism provides an excellent vehicle for removing capitalism and restoring the environment to a position of primacy in our thought. So if you look at environmentalist policies around the world, they are almost invariably socialist policies. This doesn't necessarily need to be the case. I've written volumes on how the free market can actually provide good environmental outcomes, but environmentalists tend also to be socialists. And so that's why a lot of observers have called the modern environmental movement the watermelon movement, because it is green on the outside, but it's socialist red on the inside.
So you had spoken earlier about the Green New Deal. Is it any coincidence in your mind that the crafters of this disastrous way of thinking about the future of the United States chose to call it a New Deal?
It's very much an echo of that attempt to completely redefine the American economy back in the 1930s. It's very much a conscious echo of that. And when you look at the text of the various proposals for the Green New Deal, you'll find that it's about 50% is about the environment, but 50% is actually nothing to do with the environment. It's all those social policies that I was talking about earlier. It's the policies to restructure the economy. It's policies to ensure that unions have a stranglehold over private industry. It's policies for the redistribution of wealth. A universal basic income is almost always part of a Green New Deal proposal. Much of the Green New Deal isn't green at all. It's the red part.
Many point, and you had mentioned earlier, Sweden, many point to successes in Northern Europe and Europe as to how socialism can be done right. What in detail do we need to know about those societies?
Well, I think, as I said earlier, the important part to realize is that in the 1970s, people in Sweden and in Denmark and in the UK and all those other countries rejected socialism but retained a large welfare state. I think that one of the most important things that we can realize from what they've done is that they realize that if you do want to have a large welfare state, and there are very good reasons why you would not, but let's assume you do want to have a very large welfare state, then the only way you can pay for a large welfare state is if you have a vibrant and dynamic economy that is creating wealth rather than destroying it to provide the economic basis for the redistribution. If you're going to rob Peter to pay Paul, you have to make sure that Peter can become a very wealthy man. And so these countries have realized that they have to have a dynamic economy in order to maintain their welfare state. And there is one other thing that we should also bear in mind. Most of these countries do not pay very much for their defense, because they are protected in one way or another by American military might, thanks to NATO. If they had to pay for their own defense, then I think we would see a very different set of circumstances, and Peter would have to pay for defense as well as to pay Paul. And so we would probably see much smaller welfare states were that the case.
So what is it that makes socialism fundamentally unworkable?
What makes socialism fundamentally unworkable is, as I mentioned before, the fatal conceit. It is this belief that man can understand enough about the economy and about man's relationships with other man that they can plan and manage those economic and social relationships. That is impossible. As I think I mentioned before, Ludwig von Mises, a great Austrian economist in the 1920s, looked at how the Soviet Union was trying to manage its economy and wrote a paper called Economic Calculation in the Soviet Commonwealth that destroyed the idea that any such plan could ever succeed. And that, I think, is the fundamental truth, that we just don't know enough about how the economy works and how people interrelate with each other, nor can we know enough. This isn't a question of more computing power or anything like that. It's a simple impossibility that we can ever know, ever have enough information about how these things interreact that we can actually plan the economy. So any attempt to do that, whether it is by direct public ownership and direction, or whether it is by regulation and micromanagement, any attempt to do that is doomed to failure.
So how do we make the case against socialism with those, especially those young people among us, who find its ideas and promises so tempting?
If you go back to 1977, you will find a speech by Ronald Reagan to Hillsdale College, when there was a similar attack on the American free enterprise system, and he said that it was a communications challenge. He said that freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. You have to communicate the value of freedom in order to be able to keep it alive. It is a communications challenge. As I said earlier, socialism has done a very good job of talking to people at the fundamental level of their values. We on who support the free enterprise system haven't done a very good job of that. We have to make the argument that socialism undermines these fundamental American values, and that if we don't do that, we are always going to lose the argument at the most basic level.
With about a minute here, Ian, what are your thoughts about how ripe American society, politics, and culture are for socialism at this particular point in our history?
I think that a lot of people think that there's something wrong with America, and it's that feeling that there are injustices that need to be righted, and that community needs to be maintained, and that real freedom needs to be restored to America. I think it's that feeling that there's something wrong that enables socialism to slither in and say, no, we have the answer. And until we get our act together to point out the internal contradictions of socialism and how they undermine the values that Americans quite rightly want to see restored, we are going to lose the argument. So we have to start arguing at that fundamental level of American values.
Ian Murray is director of the Center for Economic Freedom at the Competitive Enterprise Institute in Washington, D.C. He's authored the new book, The Socialist Temptation. You can purchase this book at our website. Just go to issuesetc.org, click the Talk on Demand archives page, and look for The Socialist Temptation by Ian Murray. Ian, thank you very much.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Sean Denzer joins us on the other side of the break. We're going to talk about some big myths regarding Lutheran worship. First of all, do Lutherans have a theology of worship? Stay tuned.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Hey, Todd. What have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority. They've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. Thecleaningauthority.com.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Did you know that many LCMS military personnel and their families are unable to receive Word and Sacrament ministry due to the lack of LCMS chaplains? Ministry to the Armed Forces is looking for pastors who will answer the call to serve as a chaplain to provide Word and Sacrament ministry to the men and women who selflessly serve our nation. Find out more about this exciting ministry by contacting me, Chaplain Craig Mueller, at lcmschaps@lcms.org. That is lcmschaps@lcms.org.
This is Dr. Russell Dawn, President of Concordia University Chicago, with a message for parents, grandparents, and godparents of college-bound children.
Concordia Chicago is a distinctive, comprehensive university of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. We're devoted to our Lutheran confession and committed to strong academics. Please encourage your child, grandchild, or godchild to check out Concordia University Chicago at cuchicago.edu.